from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Amid fireworks and flags yesterday, a mega-sized Chinese ship carrying 9,500 cargo containers passed through the newly expanded Panama Canal. The new and bigger set of locks there will allow supermassive cargo ships to take the century-old shortcut between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. There are big implications for money, power, ports, products. Also, big questions about the expanded canal and the global trade required to feed it. This hour on Point, the newly expanded Panama Canal. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know these massive ships, this work on the canal? What do you see coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little tape from Ilya Espino de Marata, the chief engineer of the Panama Canal project, expansion project. He talked with the BBC's Raja Iqbal about how the project will improve the canal.
The biggest container vessel that can go through the Panama Canal today can carry 4,400 containers. We will be able to put vessels that carry between 13,000 and 14,000 containers in the new canal.
Wow.
So it's big.
It's big.
It's big, and those ships are big. Jorge Quijano is the Panama Canal Authority Administrator. He announced the official opening of the expanded canal yesterday. Here he is at the inauguration, interpreted by Reuters.
The Panama Canal, 102 years ago, connected two oceans. Today, it connects the present and the future.
We're going to look at exactly what has unfolded with the opening of the expanded canal. It's bigger locks. Joining me first today from Pasadena, California, is Paul Bingham, shipping and trade economist with the Economic Development Research Group. Paul Bingham, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Can you just explain some of this expansion to us? As I understand it, before you could only get about 5,000 containers on the ships that could fit through the canal. Now you can get up to 13,000 or more containers on those ships. What did it take to make that possible, Paul?
Well, it took a lot of money. It took a lot of engineering time and planning. Original planning went back to a study almost 20 years ago before the U.S. Ceded control to Panama of the canal itself. Politically, it took a lot of effort as well. There was a referendum in Panama to approve this expansion where the citizens actually got to vote on it. The requirement for the funding was over $5 billion spent over the last 7 or 8 years, and there's still questions about what the final bill is going to be because there's still some dispute about that, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lot of planning on the part of the trade partners around the world that would take advantage of it. That includes port authorities and vessel operators and shippers that had to make investments themselves to be able to take advantage of a larger set of locks, since it's the ship operators and the shippers that ship on those ships that actually get the benefit of having the larger economies of scale from having bigger locks to allow bigger ships to go through.
This new class of ship, the Neo-Panamax, they measure 160 feet wide by 1,200 feet long. They've got a draft of 50 feet, so it's got to be pretty deep to accommodate them. How many of those, what portion of the global, I don't know, container shipping traffic out there is Neo-Panamax?
Well, it's actually an increasing amount. The share that existed 20 years ago was really defined as almost zero because people didn't want to build a ship that couldn't fit through the canal. But then some of the carriers made a decision to go with ships that would not fit through the canal, and those have been increasing their share of the global vessel fleet, if you will, for over two decades, primarily because the biggest trade in the world is not through Panama. It's actually through the Suez Canal between Asia and Europe, and the ships there can be as large as you can imagine because there's no locks. There's a sea level canal. So today you have ships actually that are much larger than will fit through the new locks, ships that are longer and wider than even the new locks can accommodate, that hold even more than the 13,000 TEU. So rough capacity limit of the new locks.
So that is 13,000 containers on there. We know how big those are. So if you're sitting in Shanghai and you've got a Neo-Panamax cargo container ship ready to go to, you name it, somewhere, let's say, in the United States, how do you decide if it's going to go through the Suez or the Panama? What's the calculation that takes place there?
Well, it's a market share battle, and most of these carrier operators are on multiple trade lanes. So they're serving all of those routes, all three of those routes, and deciding how much capacity to deploy on the relative routes based on the cargo that they're most likely to attract, because ultimately the shippers are interested in the final destination. They don't just care where the port is. They care where the customer is, and that could be Chicago, or it could be, you know, Dallas, or it could be Boston. And that influences the routing and the time it takes to get that cargo to its ultimate destination. So if I'm sitting in Shanghai, I want to be able to serve the trades that bring cargo around to, say, the East Coast, which then may take me on a route through Panama. The decision is a cost decision and a time decision. It takes a certain amount of time to sail on the oceans, and you have to pay tolls if you go through canals. There's another route. Even you could go around the Cape if you wanted to. You could sail all the way down around the Cape to go all the way on the water and avoid the Suez or the Panama Canal entirely. And that's actually happened this year, believe it or not, with low fuel costs and this excess overhang of vessel capacity that exists. There's another choice, which is the traditional one in the U.S., which is shipping the cargo into the West Coast and then putting it on a train or trucks if it's not going quite so far to get it over to the East Coast. That was the original service that was set up many decades ago, and it's still used intensively because it's the fastest way to get the cargo without using an airplane from Shanghai to, say, New York or anywhere anywhere in the U.S., actually.
Paul, who's ready for these Neo-Panamax-class container ships? What ports in the U.S. can handle them? And I guess the East Coast in particular, or maybe it matters on both sides.
Well, yeah, ultimately it matters on both sides because of competition. But on the East Coast, it's primarily been an issue of the depth of the channel. Could a laden ship come in and not scrape its bottom? You know, how do you actually get a vessel into the port? And for other reasons, there have been ports on the East Coast with much deeper channels for a very long time, and those include Norfolk and Baltimore. New York has gotten approval and has deepened as well. Miami has done so recently, and deepening projects are underway in Savannah and also in Charleston, all to be able to accommodate these larger vessels when they're loaded up enough to actually require that much draft. In addition, though, there's also such factors as the size of the berths. You have to have the length to be able to handle a ship of that size. And in the channel, you need to be able to, say, turn those vessels around to be able to have them sail back out again. So turning basins sometimes used in the channels. And additionally, in some ports, there are constraints for certain terminals, like in New York with some of the terminals with what's called the air draft. It's the height under the bridge. In that case, it's the Bayonne Bridge. Can you get your ship to sail under a bridge without hitting it? And that can be another severe constraint. And in fact, it's such a constraint in New York that they're spending over $1 billion to raise the height of that Bayonne Bridge just to accommodate these ships that can now come in through Panama.
How about Tampa, Florida? They got a pretty big harbor port operation there. What's their air clearance look like?
They are actually Tampa's bound more by the fact that Tampa Bay's channel is relatively long, and it would be very expensive to dredge it to 50 feet. So that is actually an obstacle that they face in terms of the channel depth, and that's true in some other ports as well, where really it's the expense on the dredging side, which is typically the single biggest cost to any port to be able to expand to accommodate these large vessels.
Paul Bingham, please stand by. I want to bring in Jim Newsom, if I may. Walt Bogdanich right now. He's investigations editor for Business and Finance Desk at the New York Times. Co-wrote with Anna Mendez, who joins us in just a moment, and Jacqueline Williams, a big report on the New Panama Canal in the Times last week called The New Panama Canal, A Risky Bet. Walt Bogdanich, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've raised some big questions about how this construction deal was put together and whether it faces a market with some reduced global trade now. Paul talks about the excess overhang of vessel capacity. Does the construction add up for a good future here? Does the demand add up, Walt?
Well, as they say, time will tell. But we've interviewed dozens and dozens of people who were involved either in the project or as consultants or maritime experts. And they've concluded that, you know, the future of the canal is cloudy at best, as we reported. I mean, there are serious questions about key elements of this canal and whether that's going to work as planned. You know, to have a fully functionally successful canal, among other things, you need three basics. You need water. You need a proper lock size. And you need good concrete. And there are questions about all three as to whether the design was proper, as to whether the execution was good. And I guess, you know, we're not predicting that the thing's going to fail. All we did is raise questions that had been expressed by very responsible, credible people.
And what about demand for the new facilities as opened over the weekend?
Well, I mean, the canal itself is incapable at this point, as we understand it, from handling those 14,000 container ships. I know there was a brief interview with Mrs. Marotta, but, I mean, the people we talked to, and we're including now the pilots, we're including the tugboat captains, they don't believe that the canal at this point, due to lack of experience, due to the constraints, due to what they say is improper planning, can really handle ships that size. It's too different from, you know, the kind of processes that they had followed in the past. And frankly, some of them have expressed concern about their own safety because you have these massive ships that are transiting in these canals and in the locks that are very small, and you have these tugboats that really have very little room to bail out if there's an emergency.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound right there of a Panamanian broadcaster at the inauguration of the new Panama Canal expanded version yesterday. Four tugboats attending to the passengers of the Costco Shipping Panama. Big ship going through the gates on the Atlantic section there. And through it went. Lots of celebration about this. At the opening of the long-delayed expansion, you had Panamanian President Juan Carlos Varela declaring the expansion a national victory, interpreted here by Reuters.
I ask all who are present to raise the only flag that will fly forever over this canal, the flag of Panama, with great pride. God bless Colón. God bless the Panamanian people. Thank you all.
Long anticipated. Here's how Alberto Alemán Zubieta, this is a former administrator of the Panama Canal, talking with WPBT2 in South Florida about the expansion of the project.
The impact that this project will have on the maritime world is going to be very large. In fact, I think that it's the second time around that Panama will change the way the commerce will move around the world.
We are looking this hour at the newly expanded Panama Canal and what it means for ports, for trade, for the flow of power and money east and west. Paul Bingham is with us. He's a shipping and trade economist with the Economic Development Research Group out of Pasadena, California. Walt Bogdanich is with us, investigations editor at the Business and Finance Desk of the New York Times. You can join us as well. Can you picture the scale of all this? Have you sailed it? Have you worked on the ship headed through this canal? Does your company's, your firm's product move through the canal? And are you in a port town? Can you handle the Neo-Panamax monster-sized cargo ships that this is designed to move? Panamanian journalist Ana Mendez joins us as well right now. She's in New York. She worked on the New York Times big piece, Investigation into the Panama Canal Expansion. She's co-founder of Nueva Nación. Email newsletter offers news and analysis on Panama and its economy. Ana Mendez, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What's the sentiment in Panama about this big new expansion? We heard a lot of pride there from the president.
Yes, everyone is rejoicing. Everyone feels like this is sort of the culmination of a generational struggle to reclaim the canal. But it's interesting to see, especially since less than half the population voted on the referendum. So people say, you know, that there was an overwhelming sense of voting yes for an expanded canal. 70% said yes, but really less than half the country voted in that referendum. So
what's the downside of an expanded canal? You know, from the outside, it would look like, well, that means you've got more capacity to handle where freight is headed.
Well, given all of the questions we've raised and given all the problems, you know, it comes down to how much money is the Panama Canal actually going to make. In Panama, the revenue of the canal ends up going to the government, and in theory, that money is used for social projects, education, that sort of stuff. But the question ends up being how much of that money is really going to be used for that, and how much money are we really going to make?
Well, Bogdanis, can you describe for us physically what they actually had to do to expand the locks to accommodate these bigger ships? What was the challenge, the engineering challenge here?
Well, the challenge is, first of all, they needed massive amounts of concrete. And to do that, they needed massive amounts of rock. And, of course, before you needed the concrete, you needed to dig the ditches. You needed to dig the holes. You needed to blast the rock out. And I talked to someone who was in charge of some of that blasting, and he said it went nearly 24 hours around the clock. There was a tremendous amount of work that had to be done right alongside the operating existing canal. So it was tricky business. And the two ends of the isthmus are very different in terms of weather, in terms of soil. The Pacific side, the tides are 18, 19 feet. On the Atlantic side, it's 2 feet. So the lock doors had to be made much bigger on one side and smaller on the other. One of the bigger mistakes was using the kind of rock that had been excavated for the manufacture of concrete, because it turned out to be sort of not suitable for that purpose. And we had interviewed one of the big bidders, one of the companies that tried to get the contract but didn't, because they bid $1 billion more than the winning consortium. And they said they knew ahead of time that material was not suitable for concrete, and they were going to import it from North America somewhere. Well, I mean, there were a lot of quick maneuvers, quick steps that were taken by manufacturers and designers. And I think now what you have are a whole lot of questions about whether those decisions were prudent and whether they will work, and whether there'll be just enough water to handle these giant ships. Right now, there's serious questions about that, and it's only going to get worse, and they don't have a backup reservoir right now.
You need the water to fill the locks to raise the ships, once they're in them, up to the height of the Gatun Lake in central Panama that they cross as part of the canal transit.
Correct. I mean, the key element here is the Gatun Lake. It's a freshwater lake, man-made lake. What it does is it fills the locks and it fills the water glasses of Panamanians who need fresh water to drink. So this is an incredibly valuable resource. And they tried digging it deeper so there would be more water, but that wasn't enough. And they had to have some rather significant draft restrictions, which means, lighter loads so the boats don't scrape the bottom. And that was before the new canal opened. And I should point out that the inaugural trip, which, while apparently successful on Sunday, mm-hmm. It was not the largest ship. It was not the kind of ship that, Panamanians were talking about really building this canal for. It was smaller, and it fortunately made it through okay, but it was also lighter. And down the road, there are going to be questions about where the water is going to come from.
First one through had 9,500 containers on it, shy of the 14,000 that go onto the biggest Neo-Panamax cargo container ships. Ana Mendez, are the old locks, are they still there? Are it the new smaller ones and new bigger ones, or did they replace the old ones?
No, the old locks are still operating, and they've been operating almost perfectly for over 100 years, and they still will operate going forward. They just handle different types of ships and different, smaller vessels.
We talked with one of the engineers who worked on this, one of the lead designers for the new Panama Canal, and raised the question that Walt has raised, and you write about in your piece, Risky Bet, in the New York Times. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. But he said, look, we made the locks not super, super large. We had to keep them on the smaller side for these big ships exactly because of the water issue. You know, you've got the El Nino, a water shortage. If you built bigger locks, maybe you wouldn't have the water to fill them, Anna.
Well, most if you go back to many of the feasibility studies before the actual canal proposal came through, they all said that they needed to figure out a way to get a new water source. And back in 99, the ACP itself, the Canal Authority itself, acknowledged this and tried taking over the western watershed of the Panama Canal to put dams and create a reservoir. But this, as we say in our story, this was not politically popular, and there was a huge issue having to displace the local community there. And they went back on it. In 2006, they got rid of the law that would give the canal control over that area, and then just sort of moved forward without this extra water. And at the end of the day, the tugboat feasibility studies say that they needed larger locks to accommodate the tugboat safely. So, you know, you have those two issues there that they didn't really address.
Paul Bingham in Pasadena, California, do you hear shipping people worried about the functionality of the expanded canal?
I haven't had concerns with the functionality, I think partly because I don't think many of the shipping lines are planning to put those maximum size ships to use right away. If we look at the announcements of the larger size vessels that are being planned, in fact, there's quite a few of them. I think there's over 50 of them that have already been identified and as scheduled to make use of these new larger locks. The sizes of those actually are not these 13,000 TEU ships. They're much bigger than fit through the old locks, but they're, say, maybe double the size rather than triple,
okay. Which
provides perhaps a little bit of for extra room for maneuvering. But I think also the assumption is that adjustments would be made over time to the operations. I don't know how expensive those could be, and obviously that's ultimately really the question from a shipper carrier perspective, is how much would it cost to fix something if it needed to be adjusted from this initial operating plan.
And you talked about an excess overhang of vessel capacity already. Why are they building so many new ones, even if they're not the super large, super duper 13,000, 14,000 container? First of all, why the excess capacity now, and why the construction going on if there's shipbuilding going on if it's there?
For some reason, there's been a psychology amongst the vessel owners and operators in the industry worldwide for the last 5 years or more, where they've been trying to chase market share growth by lowering their costs by buying bigger ships. And this is primarily with a focus on the Asia-Europe trades. So they've always figured that they could buy a new vessel that would then allow them to cut their prices and to capture more market share. The problem is when all of them try to do that, and they add more ships more quickly than there's cargo growth to fill them, then suddenly they have a supply-demand imbalance. And it's not sudden, and it's actually now quite severe, where most of these companies are losing money because they've got too much capacity chasing too little cargo. And there's also a part of the problem is
that because trade is down, Paul, with the recession after 2008 or something else?
Well, that's part of it. The pace of trade growth trade is actually growing, but it's not growing anywhere near the pace that it grew in the decade prior to the Great Recession. And that's another problem that the carriers faced, was understanding that perhaps they were in a market that wasn't going to provide them quite the fast opportunities that they'd seen in the prior decade. And that means they're having to be more patient, and that's hard for them to be, I suppose.
Paul Bingham, Walt Bogdanich, Ana Mendez, please stand by. Let me go to some of our callers here. Carlos in Miami, Florida. Carlos, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, I'm a Panamanian American residing in Miami. I lived and was raised in and around the canal, and I'm familiar with its operations and whatnot. But recently, and on the comments of the slowing of trade growth, I wanted to see if your guests could comment on this. We read that the Suez lowered their fares as much as 60% for some of their shipping traffic because China's shipping is down 10% overall, given the lowering of their traffic there, of their economy there.
Paul, what can you say to that?
Well, that's actually correct, but I think the primary reason the Egyptians lowered their tolls, they actually lowered them earlier this year before the new locks had been opened. It was partly because they were losing out the competition to the Cape route. Carriers had so many of these extra ships that they could sail them slowly, especially on the return trip to Asia. They could put a couple more ships on and still maintain a weekly service and not pay the toll at all by sailing all the way down around Africa and going around the Cape of Good Hope and heading to Asia that way. And so the Egyptians responded by reducing their tolls to try to make that cost equalized so that they'd attract those vessels back through the Suez Canal. But ultimately, they're in competition. You're quite right. The Suez and the Panama Canal compete for a proportion of world trade into North America. And what we've seen in the past few years, there were some shipping lines that shifted out of Panama and were on routes through the Suez for the same ultimate Asia to U.S. East Coast cargo.
Go to Wes calling from Telluride, Colorado. Wes, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, I just had a comment. I'm a graduate from Merchant Marine Academy, SUNY, Fort Schuyler in the Bronx. I've sailed through both the Suez well over a dozen times on a 1,430-foot liquefied natural gas carrier, and I've gone through the Panama Canal a few times on a car carrier, roughly 850 feet. Experiences through both canals are drastically different. My experience in the Suez, more so bad than good. I find the Panama Canal transits, the pilots much more professional, more accommodating, and they take their work very seriously. And as far as the tugboats, I mean, I can understand and agree with the issues with maneuvering vessels that large with limited areas to work, vessels that large. It takes a lot of horsepower, a lot of skill to move vessels like that around, especially if there's weather, although it's greatly protected in the canal. But I definitely foresee the Panamanians being able to overcome some of the obstacles that they're facing as they move forward. There will undoubtedly be some growing pains, but I think over time they're going to adapt and overcome some of the issues that they're having in terms of the mariner perspective.
West, there in Colorado, I mean, you've sailed through. Is it, when you go through the Panama Canal, or the Suez for that matter, is it a kind of all hands on deck, everybody alert, you don't want to scrape, you don't want to bump? What's the tone on the ship when you're going through the canal?
So the Suez, you bring on, it's called the Suez crew, so basically they bring on anywhere from 10 to 15 personnel. They're on standby. I've had to do an emergency docking in the Suez Canal from a ship going aground ahead of us. We basically drop a boat in the water. Suez Canal climbs up on shore, and there's bits alongside the bank there where they can throw lines out in the case of emergency. Panama Canal, it's similar, except the personnel on board more responsible for they call them mules, but they're basically electronic mechanical devices for pulling the ship through and making sure they're steady. But in terms of the crew shipping, our responsibility is just another set of eyes for the pilot. We're watching, keeping eyes for the captain, making sure we're not rubbing, and we're relaying that information with radios because we'll be closer to the water. Captain and pilot be on the bridge, and depending on the navigation watch officer, they're on the bridge, basically assisting as directed and being a second set of eyes and making sure that the helmsman is doing what they're supposed to do.
Wes, we've got it. We wish you good sailing in the Merchant Marine. Thanks for sharing that experience on the Suez and the Panama Canal. I mean, Walt, what are you going to be watching for in the, I guess, years ahead now to see if this canal is going to work, if this expansion is going to work out for shipping, for Panama, for trade?
Well, I'll be watching to see what kind of volume they have because this was a very expensive proposition, as you might imagine, a seven-year project that the locks themselves were the contract was for $3.1 billion, but it's almost double that now in terms of contested costs. So we really don't know how much the canal will cost ultimately and whether they'll be able to pay for it through the vessels transiting that canal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the newly expanded Panama Canal and what it means for ports, for trade, for the flow of power and money east and west. You can join us this hour. Are you in a port town? Can you handle these big new cargo ships, container ships? Do you know the story of how the Panama Canal expansion got built? Did they get the design and construction right? And is the extended canal opening just as people start getting allergic to globalization and global trade? What does that mean for the expanded Panama Canal? In an interview with the Panamanian news crew yesterday, Panama Canal pilot trainers said crews are conducting performance tests have been for months in the expanded canal.
We have been testing how ships behave in all circumstances, including how we rope them, how we tow them, and how we push them through.
A lot of people have been working on this expansion for a long time. One of them, out of Argentina, his family traveled across the continent to watch one of the first ships cross yesterday. This is Valerie Borchici in an interview with CNN's Rafael Romo interpreting.
My husband has been working on this project since 2007, when it was only a plan on paper, this woman says. Being here at this moment, it's a dream come true.
Let's go straight to one of the ports. We'll have a big eye on this. Jim Newsom joins us right now. He is CEO of the South Carolina Ports Authority. Jim Newsom, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
Do you have ports that can accommodate the Neo-Panamax container ships that can come through the new expanded locks, Jim?
Yes, we're ready to handle them today. We already handle about 13 services a week that are bigger than can go through the old Panama locks.
What are you expecting, then, in terms of increased traffic of those monster-sized container ships?
Well, I think what we see is rather than more shipping services, we see upsized shipping services. So where we had a 5,000 container ship, we'll now have an 8,500 TU container ship, and that's how the growth will be handled. So we see the 8,000 TU ship that you saw yesterday going through the canal being the predominant size that we'll see on the East Coast and East-West trades.
Who are you competing with for this in your ports, Jim? Is it rail traffic, transcontinental rail traffic, or what?
You know, I think there's over the past 10 or 15 years, there's been a percentage shift in Asia cargo to the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast. It's about 65% West Coast today and 35% East Coast. We think it's going to get to 50-50. And that's mainly because container traffic flows over the lowest cost route, basically. So we see that the Southeast ports will probably grow twice the U.S. port market because the last remaining restriction to moving big ships in East-West trades has been removed now with the expansion of the Panama Canal.
What about the really big ones that can hold 13, maybe 14,000 containers? Are you in that business as well, Jim?
Well, we don't have one yet, but we the new locks, as you know, can handle ships up to 14,000 TU. Mm-hmm. We believe we'll see one of those ships by the end of this year, so we're preparing for that. And that has a number of aspects. One, you have to deepen your harbor to handle them. The other is you have to build taller cranes and strengthen your wharfs. So we're doing all that now. We're investing about $1 billion in the next 5 years because really the size of ships has changed very dramatically.
We've heard some concerns raised. You no doubt read them in the New York Times about the construction and design of the expanded locks. Are you concerned as someone on the receiving end?
Yeah, I have absolutely no concern about that. If you look at the Panama Canal Authority, they are at their core a group of engineers. That's what they do for a living. The old canal never failed in 100 years, so I am very, very sure that they have done their work well, and I have no concern at all.
Jim Newsom, CEO of the South Carolina Ports Authority. Jim, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Walt Bogdanich, there's a guy who's waiting for the ships to come in. Not a concern in the world about this expanded locks.
Well, he doesn't work on the locks, that's for sure, because we talk to the people who do work on the locks. We've talked to pilots. We've talked to tug captains, and they tell a very different story. As much as they'd like to see it work, because everyone in Panama wants to see it work. I mean, this is their national identity. It's patriotic. How can anyone be against something like this? But there are issues, and we outlined them in our story, and they're sort of not – they need to be dealt with if this is going to be a successful operation. I want to stress the professionalism of the pilots and the tug captains. That was raised by one of your earlier callers, mm-hmm. and they really do care, and they are really professional. And it took some courage for them to speak to us, many of them on the record.
John in Kingston in Canada, Ontario. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. A couple of things. One, I reside about 400 meters from the canal in Panama. I got back here yesterday.
Okay.
A couple of things I'll say from the get-go. One, I enjoy your show on a regular basis when I can find it on a frequency close to me.
Great.
I'm a little disappointed in the nature of the questions that have gone on. I'm surprised that I haven't heard from any of the experts, or perhaps you've interviewed them, but we don't have any quotes from them. People who designed it, the people who provided the concrete, the QA people, the QC people, the people who did the risk management, the risk assessment, the analysis of every... I didn't work on the canal project, by the way. I just live across from it. I'm curious as to why, nobody's talking about the dramatic fluctuation in fuel prices resulting from global changes in economics. We can ask the England about that today. Politics, terrorism. The decision to go via canal to go around the South Tip is based on fuel consumption and the price of fuel. Nobody's talked about that. When you decide to build a project of this magnitude, one must be considering, I'm sure, and I didn't do this, the cost of fuel. That's what makes the canal work or not work.
John, we touched on it briefly. We touched very briefly on fuel. We should look more at that. Of course, that's what makes a Cape Passage, I assume, economically viable. You live that close to the canal. Do you feel confidence in the way things roll in Panama these days in terms of construction and design, John?
I think things are a lot better than they used to be under the Martinelli government, which the canal, the project started under and it continued under Varela. I think things have gone well and surprisingly better, given the changes in a lot of the heads of different departments and different agencies, including, ACP belongs to the government, belongs to the people of Panama. And I think a lot of the corruption that took place in the previous years, and I've been there for years and years, since before this project, that's changed. So there's a lot more QC, there's a lot more QA for those, quality control, quality and not, assurance.
John, let us pick all that up, if you'd be kind enough. And I appreciate your call and your sort of bird's eye view of the canal there. Paul Bingham, what about this issue of fuel costs? Yes, oil prices have dropped a lot. Can we expect the canal engineers and planners to anticipate that years in advance? I mean, is it their fault if oil prices go down and now people would rather just sail around the Cape?
Well, that was part of the contingency planning. There were a lot of studies done that had scenarios that looked at a broad set of variables that could change quite a bit, and that included fuel prices as one of them, but there's many other things that over from a 100-year perspective, which is really what they've got, because they've got they've been doing this for 100 years and they're looking forwards, not just to make the money back in a year here. This is a very long-term investment with a very long payback anticipated. So fluctuations in things like fuel prices certainly would be anticipated, as would be demand for different types of commodities. Another thing they didn't originally anticipate was how much demand there might be for LNG. That previous caller mentioned the LNG ships.
Liquefied natural gas, of course, yeah.
Yes, and in fact, I think the original plans didn't really anticipate the potential for how much LNG ships may be able to take advantage of this new set of locks, which would bring in toll revenue that they didn't anticipate. But of course, that's subject to further fluctuations over time as the fuel prices and fuel source competition shifts again in the world.
Anna, what's your sense? Our caller raises quality control here. You, in the piece with Walt Bogdanich and Jacqueline Williams, make the case that there's been failures in quality control. Why would that be?
Well, I don't know if I can say why, but at the end of the day, it happened. And we have everything to back our claims up. And that's all we can say right now. And how this gets fixed, I don't know. But if, we have more cracks, if there are more leaks, that's going to take a lot of money to fix. And how that gets funded, it's probably going to be with canal money that should be going to the government for other stuff. And it all comes back to the problems that we raised. It's clear as day.
Walt Bogdanich here, a listener, asks online if you can explain why they're flooding the canal with fresh lake water. Matt writes, there are oceans on either side. Why don't they use ocean water for the locks?
That's a good question. I wondered that too when I started looking at it. Well, the locks is a example of American engineering genius, really, the way they built them originally more than 100 years ago. They created this man-made lake very high up, and the water is fresh, and it operates the whole canal system, operates without the use of pumps. It's all by gravity. So you've got the lake way up there, and it rolls downhill. And
they never have to pump the water back up to keep the supply
sufficient?
Never have
to.
Wow. Okay.
Never have to.
Okay. So oceans, you'd obviously have to pump it up. That's the whole point, is to raise the ships.
Correct. So this is a far more efficient way of operating. And frankly, I mean, it's worked beautifully as long as there's enough water.
When we talked with the engineer there, they mentioned the you know, how weather changes can get involved here. Are they, and El Nino and so on, is that water, freshwater rain supply and therefore water supply sufficient to keep that ingenious design working?
Well, that is the issue. There were warnings about the impact of El Nino. There were warnings about the climate change, temperatures warming up. And, you know, it was decided not to deal with that when the construction was design was being made. And I think the people that we've talked to, I don't think they've told us that was a big mistake. Because they're going to have to get water from someplace. And that is going to be very, very expensive to do. And that will be tacked on to the cost of this project. As I mentioned just before the last break, there are $3.4 billion in contested costs on top of the original cost of the locks, which was $3.1 billion. When they have to go fish out, you know, find some other source of water, and now they have to build a new bridge over the old canal and the new canal, there are a lot of costs there. And to pay that down, they need a lot of traffic. And that is going to be interesting to see if they get it.
Paul Bingham, listeners are writing in about other transit options that they've heard about. One, the Chinese building a freight rail or the so-called New Silk Road from China to Europe. Does that come into play here at all for Panama traffic? And secondly, everybody heard about a Chinese-financed canal across Nicaragua. What's up with that, Paul?
Yeah, well, the Silk Road really is just an Asia-Europe trade railroad alternative to Suez, not Panama. Mm-hmm. But that proposal in Nicaragua, which is not a new one, it's a sort of a revived one, has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years, I think, in some of the general press. But I think in the industry, nobody really takes it seriously because it's so expensive and it does such environmental damage to Nicaragua that there seems to be a lot of opposition to that going forwards. Another route that some of the planners are taking into consideration now with global warming is a potential route above the continents. You could actually have vessels, if you have
polar.
No ice, sail a shorter distance between avoiding the canal entirely.
Just head up toward the pole, the North Pole, I guess, and do it there. Andra in Williamsburg, Virginia. Andra, you're on the air. Andra.
Hi, Tom. I grew up in Gatun. My father was a lock master on Gatun locks for like 30 years.
At the High Lake there in Panama. Wow. Okay. What do you know? What
right,
do you think?
In the town of Gatun, mm-hmm. right there on the lake, mm-hmm. and right next to the original locks. Mm-hmm. In fact, I lived on where the new locks is now. The Americans started to build another set of locks there, and the war effort ended that. So they're actually
which war, Andrew? You mean World War II?
World War II.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Two aspects that have not been mentioned. There are no mules or locomotives, a cog railway that the old locks has to stabilize these gigantic ships. And so those huge containers, once dry season comes along, and it's not dry season right now, mm-hmm. the winds are very strong on the Atlantic side. I can't imagine being in one of those little tugs, and there's problems with the tugs. In that New York Times article, it talked about how they had to cross the Atlantic in reverse because they're not very stabilized, pulling them forward.
Yeah, Spanish-built tugs,
okay,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Yes, so that's one aspect. No mules to help stabilize those ships. And the second is the attempt to address this lack of water. Next to each lock are three reservoirs. So in Gatun, there are actually nine reservoirs. That whole construction took up a whole half of my hometown. So nobody has talked about that. Those new locks, they were supposed to recycle like 60% of the water loss from the lake. Now, I assume that's going to be helpful. But when they get those gigantic new ships that they're supposed to accommodate, you know, it's concerning being on one of those tugs, especially in the bow.
Andrew, let us pick it up right here. Our time is short. Walt, we just got a minute here. Why no cog railway or mules, as Andrew says, on the expanded locks? And what about saving and recycling the water there if we're facing the kind of problems that we may have climate-wise?
I'll take the second question first. Yeah, they are trying to save water by having these water-saving basins, but they only save 60% of the water. The rest of it's still flushed out into the sea. They chose not to use these locomotives, which on the old canal worked flawlessly, running alongside the walls of the canal, stabilizing the ship, moving it safely and precisely into the new chamber and out. Well, they figured it would be too costly, and it would require too many of those locomotives. And so they went with the cheaper version, and they copied a version from Europe, but they didn't copy it faithfully because they made it smaller. And that therein lies one of the problems.
And so now you're going to have to have some super good maneuvering by the tugs in a tight space as these very, very large container ships come in. Panama celebrating the opening of its expanded locks and the expanded canal. Concerns raised at the same time. Walt Bogdanich and Anna Mendez in the New York Times. Big piece, the new Panama Canal, risky bet. You can link to that through our website, onpointradio.org. Walt, Anna, thank you very much for your work, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Paul Bingham at the Economic Development Research Group out of Pasadena, California, with us today. Paul, thanks for your insights on the expanded Panama Canal.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.